This week on the Red Sneaker Writers Podcast.
I would say keep writing the book that comes next. So at so many stages, we have to wait. We have to wait for our beta readers. We have to wait for our trusted reader writer friends. Mm-hmm. Maybe you have to wait for an agent or an editor. Keep your eye on the next project because time is so stretched out in this business. Everything takes so long. Mm-hmm. And if you put all your eggs in one basket, you're going to feel frustrated.
Welcome to the Red Sneaker Writers Podcast. News, interviews, and writing tips for people who are serious about having a writing career and want some practical knowledge to help them achieve it. Your host is the nationally best-selling author of more than 50 books, William Bernhardt.
Hello, sneakers. Hey, I am just back from Las Vegas. I mean, I am just barely boots on the ground, booted up the computer and came through the door, but I am very excited about doing this podcast today. Let's start with a shout out to my expert sound engineer, Jesse Ulrich. Jesse, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Everything good back in Oklahoma while I was gone?
Yeah, I mean, other than us having a tornado warning in November yesterday.
Oh, or the day before. Okay, though?
Yeah, we're fine. It literally just hit like a little part of one of the parks in town. Mm-hmm. But after this, I'm going to record a teaser promo for another podcast I'm about to start that might interest you for the Amazon Wheel of Time series that is starting.
Oh, that well, yeah, that starts in another week or two. I've never actually read those books because they're long. But
they're
have
long.
You?
Yes, I've read them all the way through once, and I'm restarting now in sort of preparation for the pod. And listen, I'm still not 100% sure if overall I liked the entire thing. There were parts of it I enjoyed. So hopefully the show's gonna cut away a lot of extra stuff that does not need to be in there, and actually make it a much more focused show. So.
Well, that leads to what I really wanted to ask you, because I know you mentioned last time being a Star Trek aficionado and the cruise and all. So have you seen Dune yet?
I have seen Dune twice.
At the theater or on television?
At the theater. I saw it in IMAX the first time, and then the second time just in a regular theater. I definitely preferred the IMAX one. Yes.
I'm going to assume you didn't hate it since you saw it twice.
I enjoyed it. It took, because of all the... There's a lot of emotional baggage, I guess, around this movie. And so it took me a while after the first time to know for a fact whether I liked it or not. And I really did. I was just so...
Well, good.
Yeah.
It was, Denis Villeneuve is my son Ralph's favorite director. So, you know, there was no question. We had to go.
He knows that guy knows how to make an epic shot. So...
Yeah, he does. That's right. All right. My interview guest today is Lynn Reeves, who has just released a blockbuster new thriller called The Dangers of an Ordinary Night, which is getting all kinds of terrific reviews from people like Hank Philippi Ryan and publications like the New York Journal of Books, which called it, and I'm quoting here, a true nail biter. Now, just in case you don't know, Lynn has published both nonfiction and fiction before under a different name, but this is the debut outing for Lynn Reeves. So, of course, we're going to ask her about that and many other things as well. But first, the news. Well, if you've been paying attention to any publication relating to the publishing world, you already know what my lead story is going to be. It's too big to omit. And that is that the Justice Department has sued to block the merger of Penguin Random House, really not the merger, the acquisition of Simon & Schuster. So this is one Big Five company, the biggest, buying another Big Five company, which we thought was going to make the Big Four and make them by far the biggest English language publisher around that. I mean, at this point, everyone assumed this was going to happen. The acquisition was mentioned last November, and we haven't had any indication that anything was going to prevent it from happening. And now, literally, I mean, we covered this story way back a year ago and wondered then if it would go through. But of course, we had a different administration then. And Anyway, the Department of Justice has filed a civil antitrust lawsuit to block the acquisition. Simon & Schuster is owned by Viacom CBS. And now everybody is just, you know, surprised because, it's no question about the fact that this would make Penguin Random House a huge publishing corporation and would increase their influence. But of course, that's what they want. They're trying to get large enough to compete with Amazon. From the standpoint of us writers, Red Sneaker writers, it means fewer places to go to with your manuscripts, because even though Penguin Random House has many subdivisions and would acquire more, typically people within the same corporate entity don't bid against one another, although they have indicated that they might permit that, but it's kind of hard to believe. Well, who knows what's going to happen? Penguin Random House has hired an attorney, the well-known Daniel Petricelli, to be their trial lawyer. He successfully defended AT&T and Time Warner against the Justice Department when they tried unsuccessfully to block that merger, and now they're going to go at it again. I don't know, Jesse. I mean, in the first place, if Penguin Random House threatens to become a monopoly, what exactly is Amazon?
Well, listen, the Justice Department can't take apart Amazon, but it can stop this. So... I'm a believer in a capitalism that has competing partners. So I'm all for this. But the Amazon publishing wing needs to be broken up. Like, Amazon can't be both publisher and seller and the third thing at the same time. That's one of the many problems. But you know, the Justice Department needs something to happen first before they go in and try to do that.
Well, yes, the key might be exactly what you said, that it's easier to block something that hasn't happened yet than to take apart a huge company. I mean, Amazon does a lot of publishing, but that's not their biggest revenue source. Yeah. I think if they split that off, it would not really dent Amazon too much. I mean, they're the largest retailer in the United States, possibly the world now, actually. And I don't know, unless you split up the retail business, I don't know how you make any significant dent. So I'm sympathetic, although I really didn't want to see this happen. I'm sympathetic. I get what Random House is trying to do. They're trying to get enough market clout that they can, you know, have some ability to negotiate with Amazon, but I don't know if it's going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, they're saying that they would still allow people inside one company to compete for a book. I'm like, that's never going to happen. So like, don't lie to us.
Like, yeah, it doesn't sound like corporate.
Yeah, that's not how corporations work. So
no. All right. We will, of course, keep track of this because it is an issue of significant importance to writers. Item number two. Last time on the podcast, I mentioned Copper, which is a new proposed social media platform. It's not in operation yet, but it's been proposed to be an author-specific social media platform. Apparently, it's going to do more than just be the author's Twitter. They're going to integrate author websites and much more. Now, just to be clear, I'm updating this story because they're now allowing people to get on their early adopter mailing list. So if you're interested in taking Copper for a spin once it's ready, go visit Copper Books, just like it sounds, copperbooks.com. and sign up. But I have to emphasize, this is not an endorsement because it doesn't exist yet. So I obviously haven't taken it for a spin yet, but there's some info if you're interested. Item number three, Amazon. Did we mention them? Do you suppose there's any word I say more in the news segment than Amazon, Jesse?
I mean, listen, I can find out. I can run all your things through my transcription thing. We can find out. I'm guessing it's definitely in the top three.
Yeah, maybe the and a or but nothing else. Anyway, Amazon's KDP, that's Kindle Direct Publishing, where people go to upload and usually self-publish their own books. They are now adding something, what they're calling a transparency code, to the back cover of their print-on-demand titles. It sounds like it might be somehow included in the barcode that they will automatically print on the back of your print-on-demand books unless you specifically tell them not to. Kind of like a QR code. When the reader scans the code, I'm going to guess with your phone, you can learn more about the book or leave a review, which will go on the Amazon page, or visit the book's detail page to learn more about it. I mean, in a way, it sounds like kind of a genius idea, and I can see where that would be useful unless you're concerned about what we just alluded to, how huge and dominant Amazon is already becoming in the book world. Well, look, if you don't want a transparency code on the back of your book, then provide your own barcode. Check the box that says, my cover already has a barcode, and then you won't get one of those. But if you get one of theirs, you're probably going to get that transparency code. Okay, one last story, and this pertains to a new formatting tool for PCs. Now, as anybody who's publishing, self or otherwise, knows today, Vellum is the most popular program that regular people use, you know, people who aren't quite in the Adobe InDesign League yet, but anybody can use Vellum. It's very user-friendly and produces beautiful book interiors. The problem is it's Mac only. So now there's a new program called Atticus, which is accessible by PCs and Macs because it's basically a web-based tool. It's not resident on your computers. You get in and you go to a website. This is being promoted by Dave Chesson, who's been on this podcast before. He's the guy behind Kindlepreneur and Publisher Rocket and other author-friendly programs. It's really more than just for formatting. Like, you can see that image that Jesse has just put up on the screen. It really wants to be a combination, I think, of Scrivener plus Vellum. So you can stay there for every stage. Like when you're outlining or just starting, you can say, what are my book goals? How many words am I going to write every day? And track your progress toward your goal. Then you can outline, you can put your research there, you can do your first draft there. And when you're ready, you can export it directly into the formatting and have it ready to be, you know, a book interior for KDP or from somewhere you might be going to print on demand to print book. Again, this is not an endorsement because it's brand new and I haven't used it. I use Vellum all the time. That's a beautiful program. But I have no opinion on this one yet because I haven't done it. But I know there are a lot of people who don't have Macs but still want to format their book interior. So FYI, here's something you might want to look at. It's called Atticus, just like the guy in To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus. Google for that and see if this might be right for you. All right, Jesse, let's bring on our very special guest, can we?
Yes, we can.
She seems to be doing spectacularly well, even without the help of a Cooper-targeted social media platform. Hey, Lynn Reeves, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. Okay, my traditional first question. If you could give a writer one piece of advice, what would that be?
I would say keep writing the book that comes next. So at so many stages, we have to wait. We have to wait for our beta readers. We have to wait for our trusted reader writer friends. Mm-hmm. Maybe you have to wait for an agent or an editor. Keep your eye on the next project because time is so stretched out in this business. Everything takes so long. Mm-hmm. And if you put all your eggs in one basket, you're going to feel frustrated.
So are you actually thinking about your next book while you're writing the previous one? Or
yes.
Do you start the next book while, I don't know, while the beta readers are reading or something?
Yeah. So I think that each book has its life cycle. So coming from the idea to the research, to the drafting, to getting feedback. So by the time I've got a draft and I'm out with readers to get feedback before I move forward, I am starting at least conceptually or doing some research on the next one. So that's what I mean. It's sort of a bit of a relay. And for me, what I have found is that that's been helpful to me in having some momentum book to book.
I'm getting the impression you're not the kind of writer who takes a 2-year gap between books or takes vacation time. You're going from one to another like a professional, sounds like. Am I right?
I do look at it as a profession. I put the effort into it with the goal of publishing my work and having it out in the world. But again, there are times when the publishing machine takes longer than I would like it to.
Right.
So sometimes there is time between books. I don't, though I have a book coming out now, I have a book out now, and I have a book coming out a year from now. That's actually unusual for me. Usually there's a few years in between.
Mm-hmm. Well, given how successful this new book looks like it is already, I mean, it's just out, and I'm not exaggerating, people. These are stellar reviews this book is going. Go, you know, look online at one of the sales pages and you'll see what I'm talking about. The Dangers of an Ordinary Knight, a true nail biter, they're saying. Where'd the idea for this come from?
Well, you know, as a writer, and I know your writers that listen to your program really know that sometimes you're getting ideas from a bunch of different places, and suddenly those ideas collide and you know you've got something. Mm-hmm. So I would say that I knew I was going to write a novel that was set in the theater because the theater is really important to me. And I thought it would be a wonderful place to examine the masks we wear in our relationships. And at the same time, I also knew that I wanted to write a novel about the impact of addiction on families, particularly on marriage and parenting. And suddenly, when I thought about sort of what is inherent in the addiction experience, which is that people are often not truthful with one another, they are sometimes trying to protect the addiction over the results of the addiction and how it impacts their relationships. I suddenly knew that the theater and the masks we wear and the idea of addiction and not being forthcoming with the people we love were ideas that actually went together. So they weren't two separate ideas. They really were informing one another.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I mean, what a perfect premise for a thriller, basically. Mm-hmm. And if we're, you know, the progress of the book is it gets from bad to worse. And that is certainly true in this one. Now, I teased everybody in the intro that you have written and published books before, but this is the first one under the name Lynn Reeves. Why the name change?
Yes. So my full name is Lynn Reeves Griffin, and I have written nonfiction under my professional name with my credentials as a registered nurse and family counselor. And so Lynn Reeves Griffin has always been the name that I wrote my nonfiction under. And then when I turned to fiction and I was writing what the industry deemed book club fiction, they didn't like the three names. They wanted something that was just two names, the Reeves Griffin. You know, do we shelve it under Reeves or do we shelve it under Griffin?
Seriously? Yep. I've never heard that one before. Wow.
Yep. So we went with Lynn Griffin for those books. And then because this novel is a departure, though I would still say it has a lot of book club elements to it, it's definitely squarely in the domestic suspense category. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, when publishers said, let's make sure to cue readers that it's a bit of a lane change. But at the same time, we don't want to hide who you are. We don't need a pen name. We don't need to. We actually do want to capitalize on the people that know you in the professional sphere around family counseling and also who know about your other books. So we went with Lynn Reeves. So I'm out there in the world under all three names. And and so far, so good. It's not posed any confusion. And again, wow. I think it's because we're not trying to keep anything a secret.
Right. Well, I thought it would be because this is a departure, and but three names is confusing. That's new. And yeah. Speaking of clearing things up, I know people are going to ask, what's book club book? What are book right. club books? What's that?
So in the publishing world, anything that is deemed upmarket fiction that sits between the commercial genre fiction primarily and that which is deemed more literary. Now, mind you, my disclaimer here is that I don't adhere to those those conventions. I think a great book is a great book. But in the publishing world and in the marketing, you know, departments and in the bookstores, those genre conventions are important. And so fiction that sits between commercial and literary and actually can be used to discuss social issues is deemed book club fiction. And I've always been very proud of that label, frankly, because if people want to talk about the social issues in my novels, I'm all for it.
So is the key the social issues? Or, I mean, usually when I hear publishers talk about upmarket fiction, I think, well, it's genre fiction, but they don't want to say that. So, or it's genre fiction, but ours is better than other people's genre fiction or something like that. But the inclusion of social issues, that's an interesting take. Is that the defining characteristic, or is that more unique to your books?
I think it's a little bit of both. I would say that upmarket is that kind of, we've got to talk about this kind of book. It's the book that compels people to want to discuss it. It's the type of book, and book club fiction too, I would say, it's the idea that you read it and you have to talk about it with somebody, right? It's that feeling. So I guess I've got the overlay that it's the social issue piece, and all of my work, again, given my family counseling background, it all comes from a place of feeling like there's an issue at hand that I want to explore as it affects families. And that's always where I start. The plot, the setting, that comes next for me. The issue and the characters always come first.
Sure. You know, your previous books were about parenting and family life. Talk about that a little bit. Where did those come from?
So as a family counselor, you hear story all day long. People speak in story and they want to give voice to their stories. And what I found in that professional realm is that there are some universality to particular kinds of stories, but there's always the personal. And it kind of calls up that James Joyce quote, in the particular, right, is the universe. And it's that idea that we all have stories to tell. And when I first turned to writing fiction, it became important for me to think about the issues that I was hearing a lot about. I've got a novel that's about the grief of losing a child and what that feels like to be a parent and yet your child is no longer with you. What does that feel like? And I wrote about that in Life Without Summer. And then I wrote in another book, Girl Sent Away, about the adolescent wilderness behavioral camps that parents are sometimes left with the last resort of sending their child to a place of tough love when they don't know how to handle their child's mental health issues. So there's always an issue at hand for me. And in The Dangers of an Ordinary Night, it's addiction.
Let me say while I'm thinking about it, because I can see that some people are watching this live, if you have a question you'd like to put to Lynn and have her answer, please just type it into the chat box and we'll see that she answers it. In fact, there's one now from somebody who's watching this on Facebook. I think this is a reference to what you were saying earlier about having more than one book going at once. This person is saying, well, I have at least two in progress at a time. Is that too much? What do you think, Lynn?
I think that's it's a question that has a kind of complex answer. I think that the question is not whether it's too much. It's the question about whether or not you're focused on where they each are. So again, if you're tag teaming, if you're going back and forth because you're not focused, right, and you don't know where they go, then I would say perhaps you want to narrow your focus and work on one. However, if it's that they're at different stages or they're calling to you for different things, for example, one is saying you need to do more research and the other one is saying you need to know more what your pivotal scenes are, well, then that's clarity. And those novels then are telling you what they need from you. But again, if it's just that I'm not focused or I keep going back and forth because I'm having trouble making a commitment, then it might be more of an issue.
Yeah, this book is being published, and now I'm talking about Dangers of an Ordinary Night. The book is being published by Crooked Lane Books, which I love, a good quality mystery thriller, but independent house. They're distributed by the aforementioned Penguin Random House, but but not produced by them. How are you finding that? You know, it's still not a small press, but it's smaller than the big five. How are you finding that experience?
It's been a fantastic one. And I mean that with great sincerity. There is a team of people that are dedicated to your book from the outset, from its acquisition. And that team of people really understands what you're trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And the distribution of Penguin Random House is that cherry on top of the sundae, because it makes sure that your book is really available wherever books are sold. There are no stumbling blocks in discovery. There are no stumbling blocks in access to anyone who wants to get the book. But you get that small press feel by working with a team of people dedicated to your book who really understand domestic suspense in my case, but also mysteries, thrillers, and so on.
I think that's fantastic. And I think that's almost emblematic of what's happening in the publishing world right now, that, you know, pluses and minuses all around, but the big five isn't the whole world.
That's right.
How'd you get started as a writer? Did you have an agent? Did you have a best friend? How'd it happen for you?
Yeah. Well, as I say, I was in my counseling career, minding my own business, listening to stories all day. And suddenly I got the idea for a novel. And I thought, I'm a creative person. I've always, you know, I acted in theater, and I was always, you know, my storytelling was more on the stage. But I really wanted to explore writing a novel. And I thought, well, you know, I can do this creative pursuit just for myself. And I had an agent at the time for my nonfiction. And the agent, I approached, you know, at one point I mentioned I'm working on a novel. And, mm-hmm. you know, she said, well, let me see it at some point. So I did let her see it. And I still really didn't think I was going to be published. I really thought it was a creative pursuit for myself. But she said that it had potential, and she offered to represent it, and she sold it. So for my first couple of novels, she represented my nonfiction and my fiction.
That's fantastic. And you've been going strong ever since, right?
Going strong, going strong.
Here's another question from Karen. She asks, Jesse, I'm doing the one about characters, and you may need to put it on the screen because I can't quite see the bottom. Okay, now I figured it out. Lynn, do all your characters have a flaw that they try to keep hidden and you're trying to uncover, I think is what she's asking.
Yes, yes, that's a great question. So I would say I'd break your sentence into parts. Do all my characters have flaws? Absolutely, because all people have flaws, right?
Yeah.
So even the people that we love the most and even ourselves have flaws, and they are actually the drivers of our experience. It is those things that we feel that we're not the best at, or the qualities that we don't like to look at in ourselves. Those are the things that we spend a lot of time thinking about, and that should be the same for your characters. Now, do they keep them hidden? I say a little bit yes and a little bit no. Because the truth is, most people already know what their flaws are, and they're kind of intimate with them. And so it's not my job as an author to uncover them. It's my job as an author to let my character experience them, experience the upside of those flaws, mm-hmm. and also experience the consequences of those flaws. So I break that sentence down. I say yes to flaws, not necessarily hidden, and not to be uncovered by me, but to be uncovered by the character.
It would probably be hard to have any kind of thriller or mystery if people never did anything wrong, right? Perfect
right.
People.
Nah. Yeah. And I don't think fiction can be where people don't do anything wrong, because that's not humanity. Humanity is that we're all doing our best and we all make mistakes. And the things that most trouble us are the things that we most need to figure out.
Yeah. Here's a question from Sharon. She's asking, in your opinion, what has been the biggest change in the publishing industry over the last 10 years?
It's that it's gotten very big. So I heard your news segment about the potential merger. And I would say that I published with Penguin back in 2007, and it was just Penguin. And it was just an imprint at Penguin. Mm-hmm. And the imprint was like a little small press because it was a small, focused, nonfiction parenting was what it was focused on. And And of course, it's changed quite dramatically since then. I think that there's also another big change, and that is that a lot more people have access to put their book out in the world.
Obviously,
And that is a double-edged sword, because mm-hmm. sometimes that means that writers are putting out work that isn't ready for readers. But for those who are putting out really wonderful work through self-published press or small press or hybrid press, it's harder for those good books using that path to stand out amongst the people who are using those paths and the work isn't quite there yet.
Right.
So I think that's tricky. And then the whole online thing, discoverability. It's really hard to get above the noise. It's very mm-hmm. noisy in the world. It's very noisy on social media, and you're trying to get noticed with all the noise that's out there.
That's so true. That's something that was much discussed at this conference I just attended, because good ideas come up. You know, let's try BookBub, let's try Amazon ads, let's try newsletters, but pretty soon everyone's doing it, and then it's not very effective anymore. And somebody's got to try and figure out something else. But most writers would rather be writing books, not figuring out how to market them, right?
That's right.
I mean, I say that, but here you are doing this podcast, and I bet this isn't the only one you've done, right?
Right. Well, the way I look at promotion and publicity is has evolved, shall we say. So with the first nonfiction book, with the first novel, I did everything that everybody asked me to do. I figured I'm going to give it the best shot I can by literally taking the world by storm, however tired I may be. Mm-hmm. But as I have matured and I have a number of books under my belt, I now really look at it differently. I want to enjoy this process. Life is short. I've written something that I want to talk about. I've written something that I want readers to talk about. Mm-hmm. I care about the time that I spent immersed in the story with the reader in mind. And so now I want to engage, but I only want to do that in ways that feel authentic to the book, that feel authentic to me. And so I'm doing the things that feel right for the book. Mm-hmm. I'm with you today because I really care about writers and what they're experiencing and how to navigate this world. It's important for me to have people understand why we make certain choices related to genre, or why we care about promoting our work, and right. whether you do that and it gives you energy and joy as opposed to feels, you know, painful. I don't want that experience.
Here's a question from Sharon, and Sharon, feel free to clarify, because I'm not totally sure what she means, but I'm going to let you wrestle with it because she's asking the question to you. She says, how have you postured yourself to remain relevant?
Okay, well, I guess I would interpret that as how in a world that is constantly changing, do we provide stories that will connect with people, perhaps?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
I guess I could also take it as I'm a little older, and how do I remain relevant to people who live in a world that is geared toward younger folks? Mm-hmm. But I think both, the answer to that would address both, which is that I try to write about issues that matter to people now. And it doesn't matter how old you are. Addiction is impacting families everywhere. It doesn't matter whether or not you are in an intimate partnership with somebody who struggles, or whether your child struggles. Families are being impacted by addiction, and we don't like to talk about it. If we had diabetes or heart disease, we would tell it, I got diabetes, I have heart disease. But we don't talk about addiction or mental health issues in families. It's still behind stage. It's still sort of not discussable, not out in the open. And I really wanted this book to entertain people in a way that they wanted to talk about it, that they would have a little bit of safe distance. A little bit of safe distance. I don't need to talk about my family, but I can talk about the family in this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's probably better. At least at least at Thanksgiving, that'll be better.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about your writing process, will you? Do you you get up every morning at the crack of dawn and write, or maybe more intermittently, or what's your process?
I'm definitely a morning writer. I feel like I'm freshest and more open to inspiration in the morning. I don't like to go on social media or answer a bunch of email before I get into the creative process, because then I start thinking about all the other things that I might need to do. Or somebody pulls me away because I read an email that felt urgent and then I'm not writing. So I start in the morning early, not terribly early, not, you know, crack of dawn. I think 7:30 seems reasonable. And I inhabit the story where I left off the day before. And I do a number of things. There are times when I may have a really busy day and I simply can take notes. Or it might be that I know that I need to work on a snippet of dialogue, so I'll do that. Or I may sketch out some of the purposes of the next scene. I do think about scene purpose a lot. I don't just write scenes and let it see where it takes me. I think of a scene and I say, why would I need a scene like this? What would have to happen here of import? And so I might really be writing. I might be researching. I might be just looking at snippets. Or if I have a super busy day, I may just be reading over what I read the day before. But I try to touch the draft every day in one way or another, so I don't come all the way out of the story right. And then have to get all the way back in again.
Yes. Keep it in your head.
Exactly. And then those characters live with me. So then I stop writing because I have to go answer those email, or I have to go, you know, see some clients or teach a class. And they're still with me because I allowed them to enter my consciousness early in the day. And it's still running in the background, so to speak. And then the day can go in whatever direction it's going to go in. But at least I'm still inside the story.
Sure. Do you have you've written several books now. So do you have a wish I'd known then what I know now, something you've learned about writing along the way?
Oh, so many things. I wish I had known that every book is its own book and that what I learned before probably won't be necessary for that one. Mm-hmm. And that you can't sort of rest on your abilities book to book. They each have their own DNA and you really have to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Right. Don't imitate.
Yourself. And it's don't imitate thyself. It's really okay to feel like you're floundering in the beginning of a draft. That's part of the experience of trying to dig deeper, is to not know quite where you are. I used to think that was a problem, and I now know that it's not. It's actually part of the process, to say, where the heck does this thing go? Right. Mm-hmm. So that's a good lesson learned for me. I also wish that I had known that every story takes as long as it takes. Mm. I used to think, wouldn't it be nice if they all could be plotted on a timeline and this one takes me a year and I can write another one in a year, but it doesn't work that way. Some of them take longer. Some I've had one novel take me, 5 years and another novel take me 15 months. So they each come to you in their own way.
Are you under contract right now to do another? Because usually deadlines create their own timeline for getting books done.
I am. I have The Dangers of an Ordinary Night came out this week, and my next novel, Dark Rivers to Cross, comes out next year. So that one is in production.
So it's largely done. Is that fair to say?
It's largely done. Yes.
But it's not a sequel to Dangers of an Ordinary Night, right?
It isn't.
Is it thriller-ish or
it's domestic still in the category. Suspense? Yes, yeah. It's still in the category of domestic suspense. And it's still, again, about families. It's about, this story is about adoption. And it's about the idea that what if you and a sibling were adopted and one of you wants to know your biological family, but the other one doesn't.
Oh, sounds like a source of conflict, which yes. is what stories are all about, right?
Exactly.
We'll look forward to that one too. But hey, everybody, The Dangers of an Ordinary Night, it is a terrific book. So highly recommended. Go out and find it and enjoy it. Lynn, thank you so much for being on this podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great conversation.
Thanks. All right, everyone, that was a terrific interview, but let me give you a sneak preview about what we've got next on the next podcast, which will be on November 26th. We're having a very special guest, and that is Karen Grassel. Some of you may already recognize that name from her acting career, because she has been a very successful actor and has played, among other things, Ma Ingalls on Little House on the Prairie. If you were a fan, you will remember Ma. At any rate, she has now written a wonderful, extraordinary, honest, and page-turning memoir. I can say this with sincerity because I've already read, and I'm going to tell you, you will be thunderstruck and amazed and also impressed by what a fine writer she is. And that's coming up in 2 weeks, more or less. That'll be on November 26th. That's the day after Thanksgiving. So, you know, you'll just be sitting around anywhere. Anyway, come join the podcast, and that's your chance to ask Karen Grassel whatever questions come to mind. Please also help spread the word about my new novel, Exposed, book number 2 in the Splitsville legal thriller series, now on sale. And let me also remind you, if you're writing or aspiring to write, join our Facebook group for the Red Sneaker Writers. That's what it's called. And you can get daily updates, find out what's going on in the world in between podcasts. And you may also check out our Patreon site, Patreon, P-A-T-R-E-O-N. This podcast is ad-free. We are supported by our patrons. So if you're enjoying this podcast, please think about chipping in a little bit on our Patreon site. Until next time, sneakers, keep writing. And remember, you cannot fail if you refuse to quit. See you next time.